Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM. And all that is now, and all that is gone, and all that's to come, and everything under the sun is in view, and the sun is a great spot on you.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John, firstly.
Good. I was going to say ho, 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 Ben, but stop.
A bit early.
Anyway, good evening, everyone.
Good evening, indeed. As ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. And you can also catch us live on the World Wide Web at WCityFM.ie and also as a podcast. And we're going to start with what to see in the night sky.
Yes, as usual, just gone out in the last week or so is the International Space Station from our evening skies. Back again, January the 16th. Seems like a mountain away.
Unless you're an early riser. Yeah. It begins a series of morning passes in a few days on December 15th.
And it lingers around till February the 1st. That's ages away.
It's just not fair. Be here before you know it.
Just not fair. Anyway, Mercury this week fades and settles down out of sight in the afterglow of sunset. It's one of those planets that just comes in, you blink and you miss it, and it's gone again for a little while. So it's unfortunately not viewable or visible in our evening skies at the moment, or in any skies. Venus. Venus is brilliant. I was watching it last night, late.
In the morning?
It was in the morning, but it was still there, dark. But it's quite high, shining at minus 4.1, and it is the morning star, as we call it at the moment. It's in the southeast just before and during dawn, and it's not quite as high as it was a month or two ago, so it is slipping a little bit away. Mars, unfortunately, still way out the other side of the sun. It's millions of miles away. It's about 227 million miles or something like that. And when it gets close again, it can sneak up to about 49 million.
Thereabouts, yeah.
Yeah, miles from the planet. That's where we get to see the top and the bottom, or the north and the south, in binoculars and things like that. Jupiter, another fine sight as well. It rises around about now, and across the midnighty sort of area, it's a fine sight, minus 2.7. It's a bright white dot, and it dominates everything in the high southeast early these evenings. So, and it stands, it's around the highest it's going to get at around 9 p.m. wherever you are in the country. Saturn, dim as usual, but still quite easily to see. It's a sort of a yellowish glow high in the south-southwest just after dark. Uranus, 5.6, which is quite dim. It's in Aries at the moment and awaits your binoculars in the darkness 14 degrees east of Jupiter. So if you can find Jupiter and just go 14 degrees east of thereabouts, you will get to see Uranus through a good pair of binoculars like you have. I know, 10 by 50s, I'm not sure if you get to see those. Yours are...
An old 10 by 50 pair, yeah. All right. I actually have three pairs. I have keep a little pair in the car, they're 8 by 8 tens or something like that. Then I have the standard 10 by 50 and also a bigger 15.
And the bigger one, which
15 by 7.
Which gives you wobbly vision if you look too long through it. Eye strain and things. Yeah.
Well, they're just about...
Handleable.
Handleable, is that a word?
It is.
But if you put them on a tripod,
yeah,
grand. Depends what you're looking for, of course.
It is, yeah. Neptune, the last one, is fainter, and it's at 7.9 on the brightness scale, which is quite dim, and it's at the Aquarius-Pisces board at 24 degrees east of Saturn. So where to see these? I suppose you go out through either your front door or your back door and face south and just follow the path of the sun, the moon, and everything else follows that in between. So you can get to see where they are. So they never vary.
They shouldn't be too far off the ecliptic,
A few degrees here and there, and that's about it. But they don't appear like everywhere in the sky.
Except your friend Pluto. It can be 17 degrees off the ecliptic.
Yes, but we can't talk about that.
We can't talk about that former planet. That's for another day.
Day when they bring it back again. What I think then at the moment, and it has been around for some while, is the Geminid meteor showers. We'll go to that in a minute. I don't know where the sun rising and sunset is, because we're coming up to strange times.
We're coming up to the solstice, indeed. Let me talk about the moon first. We had the new moon earlier today, at 11:30, I think it was. And so basically we're just past new moon. It's a 0.2% waxing crescent moon, but it's not currently above the horizon, because it's so close to the sun by virtue of the fact that it was a new moon. It rises and sets around about the same time as the sun does. But when it rises tomorrow morning at 9:45 a.m., it will be a 0.4% phase. Again, that's just probably too small to see. I mean, it'd be very close to the sun. And, of course, that's not too long after sunrise. It will be due south at just before 10 minutes to 1 tomorrow. It'll have increased a little bit to 0.6% of a phase. And then when it sets tomorrow, just before 4 p.m., I should say, when it sets tomorrow at 4 p.m., again, it'll still be less than 1%. So the first quarter moon is a whole week away on the 19th at 6:39 p.m. You mentioned the sun. It will rise tomorrow in Dublin at 8:31 a.m., which is 8 minutes later than a week ago. And when it's due south of us, or otherwise known as local noon, that'll be 12:19 p.m. That's a whole 4 minutes later than a week ago. Might go into that in a bit more detail in a moment if we have time. But then the sun sets, would you believe it, at 6 minutes past four tomorrow afternoon, which is only 1 minute earlier than a week ago. And civil twilight is also 1 minute earlier, ends 1 minute earlier than a week ago at 4:48 p.m. And from then until just after 5:30, we'll have nautical twilight. And from then until just 6:15, we'll have astronomical twilight, which is ending only at less than 1 minute than earlier than it did a week ago. So, and after that, we have astronomical night. So what does that mean? It means we'll have 9 minutes less daylight tomorrow than we had a week ago, and tomorrow another 1 minute and 4 seconds less daylight than today, when there'll be 7 hours and 34 minutes between sunrise and sunset.
So
it's all because
when do we look forward to the grand stretch?
Well,
in
now,
the evening,
as you probably know, the winter solstice is on Friday the 22nd, and there'll be 9 hours and 9.5 hours less daylight than the June solstice. But although that's the shortest time between sunrise and sunset, it's not the day of the earliest sunset, which is tomorrow, actually, or the day of the latest sunrise, which is on the 30th of December at 8:40 and 20 seconds. In the morning, 8:40 a.m. and 20 seconds. And as I mentioned, the earliest sunset is tomorrow, the 13th, at 4:06 and 11 seconds. Now, today is only a couple of seconds later than that, and the day after is only a couple of seconds later than that also, earlier, I should say. To answer your question more directly, that means after tomorrow you can look forward to that.
It's a very grand stretch in the evenings.
Not that there'll still be a very grand contraction in the mornings, but tomorrow, that's the day I look forward to the most, the earliest sunset. So after that, I think, no, you won't, unless you've very accurate clocks. You wouldn't notice it, that the day after tomorrow is the sun is going to set a few seconds later than tomorrow. But you will notice it by the end of the, if you're on the lookout for it.
Yeah.
You will notice it by the end of the month.
Yep.
That there's a little bit of a stretch. And then before you know it, you'll see those little buds from the daffodils.
Daffodils first.
I've seen them, the green shoots of daffodils on I think Christmas Day or Stephen's Day, I've seen them. And yeah,
they shouldn't really be up, but they are.
Well, they obviously know they do what's happening.
They know something, yeah. So anyway, shall we talk a little bit about the Geminids? Because a fantastic time to see them, especially when tomorrow and the next day are the two peaks. So tomorrow that's the 13th, so coming into the early hours of the morning into the 14th as well. And up to this, they've been around since November the 19th and will still be around till Christmas Eve, 24th December. But you possibly, because the moon is out of sight and the signs are, fingers crossed, that the skies will remain clear for good viewing. You can get to see 100 meteors, 100 odd plus meteors per hour. And they come from all different directions in the sky, but really coming from the constellation of Gemini, which is two really bright stars, Castor and Pollux. And they're fantastic to see. Now, I was home late last night, but it was a bit dull. And the rain had been falling and things like that, so we didn't get to see anything. So, knowing me and you, we get out of the car this evening, and we'll just look around and see what happens. Yeah, but you know, sort of late in the evening, sort of midnight-ish is really the time to look at
that. Yes, when Gemini is up at its highest in the sky. Yeah. As you mentioned, you can see them anywhere in the sky, but they all seem to radiate or emanate from that direction, from Gemini. So that's why the best time is 11 or 12 o'clock. When it's at its highest. But I wouldn't wait until
No, get out there and see as much as you can, because if it changes like it can, it's not funny when you miss it as well. Now, where it comes from is it's an asteroid, this one, which is a little bit...
Normally meteors emanate or originate dust and bitty, gritty particles from comets, but this is unusual in that respect. It comes from an asteroid.
And this one's called 3200 Phaeton, Phaeton. And they describe it as an asteroid or a possible rock comet. And you get to see 120 meters per hour, well worth watching. It's travelling through space at 79,000 miles per hour. Just to give you where we are against that, we travel at 70,000 miles per hour through space. And we cross over the path of the itty-bitty, gritty bits, which pass through our atmosphere, and we get to see these little flashes through the evenings, and they're well worth watching. The Geminids are the other ones as well, but this particular one, the Geminids, really work. So where do they come from? Leftover comet particles, bits from asteroids, all that sort of stuff, itty-bitty, gritty things.
Yeah. The other good one of the year, of course, is the Perseids in August, but this year in particular, as you mentioned, should be a good time because, as we mentioned, we're just past the new moon, and tomorrow night and into the early hours of Thursday, which is when reaches maximum peak, is when you think of the sun sets tomorrow just at 5 p.m. So there'll be the moon sets at 5 p.m. tomorrow. So that'll be out of the way. So we should be, that gives us a greater chance of seeing even more of them. Yeah. Now that ZHR, or zenithal early rate of 100 to 120, is under ideal conditions. Not a speck of cloud in the sky.
Artificial
light. You have to get way out beyond the suburbs, way far away from any artificial town lights, urban lights, under ideal conditions. That's what you'd see. But even out on the edge of the suburbs, you should be able to see a few. Give your eyes at least 10 or maybe 20 minutes to get used to for your night vision to develop and wrap up warm.
Exactly. That's the secret. Although it's not that cold out. It has been colder. Yeah, it is middle of winter now and all that sort of stuff. But this asteroid, just to give you a little bit more information about it, it takes about 1.4 years to orbit the sun. So a little bit longer than we take to go around the sun. So we just take, as we call it, the 365 days, which is 1 year. And Comet Phaeton, 3200 Phaeton, takes 1.4 years. So that'll be around for a while. We'll flake through and catch up those bits and pieces and get a bit of enjoyment out of it.
And I believe this is a relatively recent annual meteor shower. It was only first discovered in the 1900s. I'm not sure why that is. the origin, the 3200, Phaethon must have been perturbed from a previous orbit. And just to make, as you mentioned, there are only little bits of dust, of grains and specks. But the fact that they hit us at 78,000 watts, over 20 miles per second, they're at 30 kilometres per second they're travelling at, that causes them to heat up when they meet the atmosphere and cause those bright streaks across the sky. So definitely keep an eye out over the next couple of nights for some geminids.
Yeah, there's a nice text in from John Dalton. Good evening, John. Hi, guys. Just tuned in by chance. There you go. He didn't probably know that we were moving to the earlier slot. Love to hear your dulcet tones again and to hear you're still looking into the skies, which we've been doing for years and years. John was involved in the...
From this parish, Centre Stage,
he was indeed. And a happy Christmas to you as well, John, and thanks for the text. Brilliant. Yep, got the number from somewhere. Don't know where he got it from. There we go. Now, just a little bit of news about the SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket, which was launching some secretive bits and pieces in underneath the, I suppose, the metal exterior, whatever it is. And we don't know what has happened quite yet, because the planned launch of yesterday was scrubbed from the X-37B, Space Heavy rocket, and it's planned to launch as early as December the 12th. Now, that's today, sometime. Now,
this evening, I think it's about 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and so 1 a.m. our time.
Yeah. So we'll, if we're awake, we'll have a little watch. No doubt you'll be, if you're awake, you'll hit us with a text and see what happens. So lift off. We're not sure exactly whether it'll go ahead or not, but we'll see what happens. 1:14 GMT, so look forward to that later on if it's going to do its thing.
Thank you, John. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and Ben Emmett, and our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032, and we're also available on the internet, live at dublincityfm.ie, and also as a podcast. Now, John, Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about the website that reviews films, but there's a story about a missing tomato,
this
should
is
say,
the most
on the International Space Station.
Most amazing thing ever. Now, I didn't hear about this up to this.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is, well, not the funny thing is, well, it is, in some ways, it's an amusing story, but because everything is so measured and precise, what they send up, because it costs so much money to send anything up there, that everything is weighted, there's no excess, and everything is measured to the nth degree, and 8 months ago, a tomato went missing, but somebody got the blame for
it. Yeah, sure did.
They were accused of eating it themselves on the sly.
The NASA friend, a good friend, Frank Rubio, has been blamed for quite a while for eating this tomato. And he's been asked time and time again, did you eat the tomato? Who, me? Eat a tomato? No, I don't think so. But it seems though he didn't, because he's exonerated from this whole thing now at this stage, because he found it behind a bookshelf up there somewhere. And the remains of the tiny tomato, because there's only 17% humidity up there, it just would have dried straight, you know, just wrinkled up and gone into something like a grape or something like that. But they did find it. Now, Frank has been home a while at this stage, so whoever was doing the spring cleaning up there just found this behind a couple of books in the bookcase.
Yeah, because I thought eight months a tomato would be totally rotten, because they don't live in a sterile environment, although I'm sure they make sure a lot of things are pathogen-free before they send them up. But I hadn't realised the humidity was kept low.
It is.
That must be very... Must make it, well, for some people, very difficult to breathe.
Possibly there's something you don't think about, but they do. They keep it around 17% humidity, I suppose, so nothing can grow or mold can grow.
Well, that would reduce the old... bacteria, the activity, the water activity, all right.
Yeah.
And you consider us, well, I know it's Ireland and it's a damp climate, but we would be, the average day would be 70%, 80% humidity. Sometimes more, of course.
Yeah,
sometimes 100%.
Yeah, over 100% in some cases. Anyway, this missing tomato was first discussed publicly. This is a serious sort of thing in behind the scenes on September the 13th when Rubio had his own event in space marking the unexpected record year in orbit for a United States astronaut. And he was up there for a good long while. He'd actually brought the tomatoes up. I suppose he came up with the rest of the stuff, the shopping, to get up into the space station. So the poor fellow was blamed for eating a tomato. He says he probably got up in the middle of the night and right snuck into the fridge. and said, I'm going to have this tomato. But it turned out not to be. And he's totally exonerated from this. And well done, Frank, for standing your ground.
Well, you would if you'd, you know, not guilty, Your Honor. They thought he celebrated by having an extra tomato above his allocation.
Yeah.
Now, Mars. Yeah, well, not so much Mars, but there's ESA are exploring a new approach to basically slowing down aircraft, or not aircraft, spacecraft, when they get to Mars. When you consider previous missions like the Mars Express, for example, that arrived at the Red Planet on Christmas Day 2003. It was traveling at 18,000 kilometers an hour, and to slow itself down to get into Martian orbit, it had to fire its main engine to slow it down enough to be captured into orbit and to avoid flying off into space and to keep going. Now, of course, that braking was successful, but it did use a whole 264 kilograms of propellant, which is a lot of propellant, and we calculate before every kilogram that you send into space, the extra power and energy and the rocket and such like has cost about $10,000 or $15,000 or something. You know, just to send up a kilo of sugar. That's the way it averages out anyway.
And a tomato.
No wonder they were complaining about the missing tomato. But anyway, that's the usual technique, and it has been used successfully for 16 Mars missions since 1971. But they're now thinking about designing a way of basically using a different technique, using air braking using the atmosphere of Mars to slow it down. They've thought about this for a long time, but they always thought it was a bit risky. They're saying, first, this method would reduce the amount of propellant that the spacecraft needs to carry, and secondly, it would mean that you could choose to arrive at a planet with a higher speed, cutting the cruise time, which of course would be very good for if and when people ever go there to Mars, rather than taking 6 months, you might be able to do it a bit faster. So, as you can imagine, you're talking about using a heat shield, and When you're using the current method of firing main engines, of course you can monitor it in real time and slow it down and speed it up, and you can do the maneuvers in real time and to make sure you do it right. But this would be a bit more automated in as far as the spacecraft would have to decide itself when it's going slow enough that it would jettison the heat shield. Or the draw, whatever they would employ some other technique to increase the drag to slow it down.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of maths involved, of course, the onboard computers have to say, "Oh, we're going slow enough now, but I jettison that whichever slowing me down, and then jettison a heat shield as well." And if they do it right, you get there quicker and use less fuel, and therefore, it would be a bit cheaper to get there, and you get there faster as well. So, and they're also thinking this would be great in future as well, not just for getting people to Mars, but also for space probes further out to the likes of Jupiter and Saturn, which, of course, take much, much longer to get there. Generally, the current way we get to those planets can take 7-8 years, depending on the route. Chosen,
yeah.
Chosen, I should say.
Yeah, very good.
Because you can use a lot of, what do you call it? Slingshots, flybys.
That's it. Alan has been on as well, just commenting, I think, on the tomato business. Looks like the ISS Columbo detective ought to catch up with humanity. He says he'll get the pressure suit on. I'm just going outside, maybe sometime. Yep, so there we go. Thanks, Alan, for that. Good. And next week, I'm going to let you into the secret of how Santa Claus delivers billions of gifts in one night. And it's a thing to do with macroscopic superposition. I won't go any further than that until next week. So there we go. And just two things just to go before we get there. India sets its sights on the moon and a base by 2047. And they want to establish their own moon base before 2050. So there's a lot of talking and fiddling around and things like that. So looking forward to see what happens there. The ISS, this is going to be interesting now. It has just turned, as we, or most of us know at this stage, it's just turned 25 years old. And it is getting ready with NASA for the end. And there's a video on the internet you can watch for this. And the agency just celebrated the milestone mission, which was on December the 6th, 1998, when it went up first. And in the run-up to that event, the plan to retire it in 2030 or thereabouts. Now, will they do it or not? I'm just not quite sure. You know, it's hard to, because they always extend these things by a little bit. So commercial activity, of course, will allow more astronauts from more countries to conduct science and technology development. So if they add bits and pieces on as they go through the next few years, but eventually it will come to an end and come to its demise with, say, the Mir space station and any of the others that have come back and burnt up into the Pacific, if anything really got down there at all.
Thank you, John. Just very briefly about colliding planets. I see astronomers found it looks like a glowing cloud of dust from a massive planetary pileup. And NASA, and they went searching for some volunteers. So this was a collaboration between professional and amateur astronomers, put some data together. And they recently published a scientific paper in the magazine, the journal Nature. And that article describes how an international group of professional and amateur astronomers teamed up to measure the heat glow of two ice giant planets colliding and see the resultant dust cloud moving in front of the parent star several years later. So it's a long story. If it goes back to 2021 when the All-Sky Automated Survey noticed a sun-like star, which is 1,800 light-years away, was rapidly fading, and then 30 days later, and somebody else picked up some strange data from that star, and they all got together and said, what's happening here? And as I say, with amateur and professional astronomers, they did a lot of spectroscopic runs and other observations and basically came up with this thesis or hypothesis. Well, it seems certain enough that it's basically two huge ice planets collided and all the debris went, formed the cloud and obscured the star which they were orbiting.
Yeah, and Alan, just before we go, Alan just reminded us of the Antarctic end where bits of Mars were found in the snow at the South Pole. And I remember that, and well, seeing pictures of people probing around, because it's easy to see any bits and pieces that fall because there's a a bit of a hole where it's hot, but they're normally dark so you can see them easily in the sun. Anyway, that's about it, unfortunately.
Thank you, John. Thank you for your news items and for driving the sound desk this evening. Our email address for any questions, comments you may have is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to James Sweeney and Conor Lennon for making this show available as putting it up on astronomy.ie. But that's all from me, Ben Emmett, for this edition of the Astronomy Show. And now it's music all the way until 2 a.m. here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Up next, it's Brendan Lynott with Threads. And then from 10 p.m. to midnight, Nigel Wood with Ear to the Globe, and from midnight till 2 a.m. it's After Hours with Dave Barry. Please join myself and John at the same time next week. We'll be back with all the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening and say goodnight, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John.
See you. Bye-bye.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.